This is an ABC podcast.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Lolly snakes at halftime or at the end of games are causing some pretty big debates around sporting venues across Victoria. Gone are the days of the orange quarters, and some parents aren't happy about how freely they're being passed around. So, is it a big deal? When is a lolly snake at a basketball, netball or soccer game more than just a lolly snake? What harm are they actually causing? Maybe you've got kids who aren't allowed to have one, then you've got the friction that is caused between parents around what food is appropriate and what is allowed. So whoever would have thought that we can ask, what is the lolly snake teaching us? What is it teaching us about how we label food as good and bad? When does education around food become fear or food anxiety? What about the concept of using food as a reward? Who would have thought that that brightly coloured, stretchy, gummy snake could represent a bigger picture around food, emotion, labelling, guilt and food anxiety? From trying to educate ourselves about how to do the right thing, have we actually created a fear around so-called good and bad foods and when we are and aren't allowed to eat it?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Good morning. My name's Rochelle Hunt, and joining you for this hour, Dr. Sandro Di Meo, the CEO of Vic Health. Sandro, honestly, the lolly snake at the moment, it's kind of up the top of all of the things that we're debating as a society around food, what we can and can't eat, what is good, what is bad, whether or not we should label food, when we should pass food around, how much we understand around what's good and bad for us, and then you add emotion and guilt and fear and all this stuff on top of it. Oof. How did a lolly snake become so deep?
I know. It's like almost like a snake gate. it's a challenging one because, you know, you think on one hand you're there on a Saturday morning, you're playing sport, kids are running around, they need energy. So you might say, well, give them some energy that also they enjoy. But the problem is that, you know, when you start to associate on one hand, you know, foods as either being good or bad, which leads to kind of very binary ways of thinking about food, and then shame and guilt if they're eating the wrong type, you know, being seen to kind of quote unquote wrong types of food. But then on the other hand, you don't want to glorify these foods either, because if you, you know, associate unhealthy foods with performance or with reward, then kids from a very early age, they actually can make connections in their brain of, well, if I do well or kind of, you know, good performance equals junk food. And you know, industry obviously preys on that through advertising and really leverages that. But as an uncle, that makes me, and as a doctor, that makes me really nervous. So, I mean, it's tough. I feel for parents. It's become a really fraught, difficult conversation.
I feel like as we are trying to educate ourselves and our kids more around food and what goes into food, because a lot of the time, right, we're being health washed around what's healthy and what's not.
It's become a huge industry, a huge conversation. Yeah.
So we're trying to get ourselves around labelling what sugar content is, what sugar even is, and how that's labelled. So we're trying to educate ourselves on one hand. But I feel like there's this really fine line of when that then tips into fear and anxiety around what you're eating. And a little later in the program, we'll talk about how that does tip into things like eating disorders. But how do you find that balance between educating yourself and at the same time not freaking out about a lolly snake every time a lolly snake is around?
Look, I think it is a really difficult one. And I hear this from patients as well. People, you know, even adults find it difficult to understand what is healthy and what isn't. You know, the science has changed. We were told for a long time fat was bad. Now we're told fat is good. People demonize carbs. Well, I eat a lot of carbs. I mean, carbs are the basis of the modified Mediterranean diet, and that's the reason my nonna lived to 101. You know,
as a Gen Xer, I feel like Gen Xers were really told carbs were bad.
Well, we've been told everything's bad at some point, and that's kind of where some of the confusion comes from.
The food anxiety stays with you.
If I'm really honest, no pun intended.
Every time I eat carbs, there's a little bit of guilt that I'm serving myself with it.
Well, and you know, the cynic in me is, you know, would say that's because that's what sells. You know, if you can make people kind of really acutely worried, get people, you know, they kind of a bit concerned, a bit confused, then you can sell them, you know, so-called health foods, which, you know, don't even get me started about like the health food industry. But this whole area has become sort of so weaponized, so emotional, so judgment filled. And I think it's a really important conversation because, first of all, I think that the first step is to understand ourselves as adults. There really are no healthy or unhealthy foods, good or bad foods. There are foods that are more healthy and there are foods that are probably, you know, we should be eating, as Elmo says, sometimes. Then it's about how do you have those, how do you pass those on to kids, but in a way that doesn't pass on judgment or shame or fear? And I think the best way to do that is through a really kind of positive language, focusing on celebrating food, focusing on the things that we want to be eating more of and the way food makes us feel rather than necessarily how it makes us look.
So who's going to have the guts then as a mum, a dad or as an uncle to rock up to their next basketball or footy game with a big Tupperware container of orange quarters?
Of orange quarters.
There's a text here that says, we took oranges to basketball cut in quarters. The kids loved them. A positive program with good ideas for good snacks at halftime would be better than this created anxiety today. This is over the top. Common sense, please. Maybe you are that person that's rocking up to your local sport with orange quarters. I know myself, I see not only one child rock up to my daughter's basketball game with a bag of lollies, I see probably four or five kids rock up with a bag of lollies. So how do we manage this? How do we have sensible conversations? How do we not demonize some food? And how do we educate ourselves without creating fear?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Good morning, Rochelle Hunt and Dr. Sandro DiMeo, the CEO of Vic Health, with you. Debates are raging around sporting fields all across Victoria about whether or not lolly snakes should be handed out freely. But how do you put that genie back in the bottle? Can we ever go back to the day of orange quarters? And then when you throw a bigger lens over it, what is it teaching us about food, how we label food, when we should be eating some foods, and that emotional guilt that comes with some particular food? This text, no child wants to be left out. And another, one lolly snake teaches joy and satisfaction with one lolly snake. One lolly snake, some foods are okay in moderation. That is the key to a healthy relationship with food. Let's have a chat to Georgie. She's in Warrnambool. Morning, Georgie.
Morning. How is it? How are you? How is everyone?
What do you want to share?
I'm a mum of three. I've got teenagers down to primary school. I'm in my late 30s. And it just starts from the grassroots. It starts at home in the way we talk about food, how we gather at the table. We go back to our the way our grandparents used to have a pot of herbs and our tomatoes and things at home. And we celebrate how that is grown and nurtured and then brought into the house and shared amongst us. We talk about it on our plate.
So what happens then, George, if your kids go to basketball and then lolly snakes are being handed out as freely as orange quarters? Do you care about that?
Yeah. I used to when they were very young, because it was just a free-for-all back in those days. But they are old enough to make that choice for themselves with their own knowledge. And it's all about balance. I'm never going to stop them go trick-or-treating and things. That's all part of life, at parties, all that sort of thing. But it's just knowing where it comes from and they can choose for themselves.
That is a good point, actually, Georgie, because as kids get older, obviously their autonomy, their insight over what, you know, being able to make those sorts of decisions, it does increase. And I think it's a good point that, you know, as kids get older, those conversations can become more nuanced and even at some point kids will make decisions for themselves. But I do think, you know, really early in life when kids are still developing connections with food and an identity around food, making connections between reward and certain types of food, I do think we need to be a bit more careful.
they're also making connections with friends and they're figuring out where they fit into the group and the clique. And you also don't want to be seen as the kid who's not allowed to have something. And if you're that kid where you think, oh, God, oh no, I'm not allowed to have this and everyone else is having one, I really want one, that creates this fear around food that I think is just as unhealthy. Let's bring in Alex Chung, Senior Lecturer, Vic Health Postdoctoral Research Fellow from the Department of Nutrition, Dietetics and Food at Monash University. The lolly snake, one person here says this is not a debate. And then if you could see the rest of the texts that are coming in, prove that this is bigger than the lolly snake, Alex.
Yeah, I can see that this is much bigger than the lolly snake. There's so much emotion when we talk around food. And I think when we're talking about getting our kids involved, people have really strong opinions about this. And even just listening to the intro and you and Sandro talk now, there are so many things I'd love to unpack. I think for me, there's a couple of things. And first of all, I think we'd love to see that sports are where health is really promoted at the forefront. So when our kids go to play footy or basketball, it's a healthy place where healthy behaviours, and that's obviously physical activity and healthy food, are really promoted and encouraged. And I think for me, if we set up an environment where food that we really consider to be treats are sort of left aside from some of those places and we're instead promoting healthy food, nutritious food that we want our kids to be eating every day, then this conversation doesn't become quite as turbocharged. Parents aren't faced with that situation where they're having to decide about whether or not they want their kid to be eating the snake at basketball because they're not actually there anymore.
Yeah.
The snakes are not there. We're eating healthy food. And
that's never going to happen though. I don't think that genie can go back in the bottle, unfortunately. They're everywhere. They are like everywhere. And it's the only thing that's sold pretty much at the canteen when you walk in.
Yeah, that's a problem, I think. And I don't know if we can put that genie back in the bottle, but it's something that I'd like to strive for, I suppose. If we want our kids to have good relationships with food, we certainly need to be promoting healthy food in all of these places, whether it's taking the kids to the MCG on the weekend or taking them to their local basketball or Little Aths. I think we want to really try and encourage and create healthy food environments. Mm. But I do recognise that's not always the case. There's, you know, there's an environment that we live in and we have to work within that. And then I think that's where we need to have this conversation about how we talk about food, and certainly setting up foods as good or bad treats and rewards can be quite difficult.
Because anecdotally, I was throwing this around the office today and people were talking about, well, I really hate it when someone just throws a bag of snakes in front of my kid because it's not how we operate as a family. And then others talking about how there were anecdotal reports of kids hiding and burying certain snack bars at school because there was such bad press and media around them and how sugary they were. They were sort of being held up as the lolly snake at the time. So there were kids basically burying their LCM bars. If we ever go through the apocalypse, I think we can go and dig up
and find
school playgrounds
is a source of
food. Don't want kids carrying that kind of stress.
No. You do not want kids to be carrying that stress or to be feeling guilty or worried about what's packed in their lunchbox. You want kids to really grow up where they can enjoy food, they can share food with their friends at birthday parties and that kind of thing. You want them to share food with their families around the table. We want our kids to have a healthy relationship with food where they're not feeling shamed or worried for having a particular food in their lunchbox.
Alison says box of bananas at Frankston Little Aths for the kids is free, but the kiosk does also sell lollies. Is there a role for someone, government, Sandro, for supermarkets? I mean, the supermarkets need some good press now. We all know that. Like, what if there was free fruit? That's hard to say. At sporting venues, on the canteen. I don't know who could supply it, but surely, I mean, we're hearing that food is being thrown out, that we have excess waste, that we've got all this food wastage. Can we make it free?
And we've also got, you know, rising issues around food insecurity among young people as well. And, you know, I think what Alex was picking up, though, it's about changing kind of the default. So it's not demonising the individual. It's not, you know, I think we have to be very careful not to make parents feel blamed or kids feel shame about what's in their lunchbox. That's definitely not what I would support. But, you know, we've done so much good work over the last 10 years about improving the quality of food in schools, because we know that it's not just the school environment or the teacher that has an impact on how well kids can learn. The food you eat is so important to how much kids are actually able to absorb, and it even makes a difference to kids turning up to school. You know, all of these great co-benefits from changing the school food environment, making the default food healthier, I think that's the opportunity. Then, you know, if on the odd sporting day there's, you know, a couple of snakes, I don't think anyone cares. It's more if you can't avoid it. If I take my kids to sport and they feel then judged because I'd prefer them not to have snakes, I'm left as the Grinch, you know, because I'm trying to do the best by my kids based on the information I have.
And because it's everywhere now, Alex, this is something that you touched on. Louise is in Geelong. Louise, we'll get to you in just a tick. Because it's everywhere, so I guess I find it exhausting, right? The maths that I do in my head of, okay, when are we allowed to have the treats? What treats did you already have today? You know, Mum, can I have this? Well, that depends. When you're at Buggalugs's, what did you have there? And what did Dad say yes to? And what have I said yes to? And you're constantly doing, and I'm not good at maths at the best of times. So it's exhausting.
Mm. It's totally exhausting. As a parent, you are always keeping an eye on what your kids are eating because you want the best for them. And I think it would be true for every parent listening, every parent out there, that we all want the best for our kids. I think the environment that we live in now really pushes and promotes foods that we want our kids to eat only sometimes, but these foods are in our faces every day, whether it's ads for them or the bag being opened at the sporting event. So it's much harder to avoid, and we do find ourselves having to have these conversations in our own minds. What have you already had today? Are we having more lollies? Mm. You've got a party this afternoon. We are doing that mental arithmetic, and it's not easy to keep an eye on providing the healthy choices for our kids when there are these foods that we used to see sometimes as treats now really in our faces on a much more regular basis.
Louise is in Geelong. Good morning.
Morning, Michelle.
What did you want to share?
I'm a dietitian of many years' experience, and I think we need to go back a step. It's very rare for any child's sport game. I guess we need to ask the question, why does a child need an intake of sugar halfway through a short game? A teenager, it might be a different situation, but for children, it would be very unnecessary. They would only need water in most cases. It could leave children out who weren't able to, for whatever reasons, specific dietary reasons, be able to have those lollies. But I think we need to go back a step. It's not necessary. The second comment I'd have is about messaging. Mm-hmm. What message do we give our children? If they think that in a short game they have to have a lolly to get through it, then they'll think that about running around in the garden, playing games, whatever they're doing, and it's just a silly message.
Good to hear from you. This says, gosh, come on, Rochelle, they can't ban just everything. A lolly snake as a reward should be encouraged, not looked down upon, says Anthony. Others saying, stop being nannies. Our food choices never hurt previous generations. Whatever happened to taking responsibility for our food choices? But this is interesting. This is from Sue, and it says, health has become like a badge of honour. Social media is saturated with so-called healthy, fit bodies. Mm. While I see it and know a lot of it is staged, there's still a dopamine pull to be like that, and I feel compelled to find that right diet book, and that will all solve my problems. It's been a vicious cycle for decades for me, and
well
that's
said.
From Sue. Mm. So this is not new. It does feel like it's everywhere now, but that idea of what we are sold, what we are pitched, and that unhealthy conversation you have in your head and the guilt associated in your head with food, not everyone, but some people have, like I was talking about, we were told carbs were bad for ages and ages. I eat them, but I still have this internal fight with myself. How do we manage that? Like, how do we educate ourselves and not tip it into a really unhealthy, guilt-ridden relationship with food?
I think that's where we think about not labelling foods as good or bad, and not having rules and restrictions around food about this being allowed or that not being allowed. I do think that can be difficult to balance, though, when you're talking about doing the mental arithmetic around how much sugar have we had today or how many sweets are you going to have at the party later. So I think that it's not an easy thing to do, but first and foremost, my take on this really is that we don't want to be labelling foods as either good or bad. We need to have that sort of neutral take on foods and really look to the foods that we know will nourish our bodies and make us, as you said, Sandro, make us feel good when we eat them, when we sit around a family table and have a meal together. Are we feeling good?
Using sugar, though, as a hit to get through is not new. Peter says, working as a sheep shearer many years ago, I bought glucose tablets from the chemist for an energy boost, although it might have just been more of a placebo effect. But then Sarah in Fairfield says, my kids' footy team take the lolly snake and then put it inside their mouth guard.
I don't think the dentist will be happy.
Well,
about
this
that.
Is what she said. She said, only found out when the dentist showed me the cavities we had and around what sugar they were getting.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
It all started with just handing out some lolly snakes at halftime during your netball or soccer or basketball game. And from there, it's created a conversation, a debate, some would call, around what's appropriate to serve when and what is the bigger picture telling us. Dr. Sandro DiMeo, the CEO of Vic Health, is with you. Alex Chung, Senior Lecturer, Vic Health Postdoctoral Research Fellow as well from the Department of Nutrition, Dietetics and Food at Monash University. Lots of questions, Sandro, coming in.
Lots of questions and texts, Rochelle. Yeah, there's one here. So my son has type 1 diabetes and celiac disease and it's difficult for us as he can't have lollies and if he can, they can't be gluten-free. I think it just reminds you, you know, you've got to be careful when you're serving kids in large numbers that there will be dietary needs, there will be medical needs, and having foods that are high in sugar, you know, it may not be as simple as just a conversation about sugar for some young people. There's here, my issue with jelly snakes is not the sugar but the gelatin. I hadn't thought about that. An issue with the gelatin in terms of, you know, an allergy. And then in regards to fruit as a snack, I often hear about sugar levels in fruit and that there is a limit of how much you should be eating. You know, can you please clarify that? I mean, this just shows how much confusion there is around food these days. I hear this often. I mean, fruit you can eat, you're going to end up with a bellyache and diarrhea before fruit causes any problems, you know. But people say this. They say they're worried about eating fruit because they're going to put on weight. That's absolute nonsense. Fruit is incredibly healthy. Your kids can, you know, as long as they haven't got allergies or any medical reason not to eat it, they can eat as much as they want. Trust me, there will be a problem at the back end before there's a problem.
That's what my mum always told me.
Otherwise.
And my mum would always say, I don't care if you eat that whole punnet of strawberries or that whole bag of mandarins. No. She'd say, you might spend some time
on
the toilet.
Huge amounts of fibre in there and the fructose will go straight through you. But that just shows how much confusion there is. And I think that for me is something we need to address. You know, how do we educate kids from a young age? Programs like Stephanie Alexander's program, you know, engaging kids in a really positive way early in life, really early in school, but in a way that's really, really strengths-based, that's connecting kids with food and cooking and where our food comes from. Not talking about good or bad, but just talking about pleasure and enjoyment.
And that idea of good and bad and how food makes us feel in inverted commas. Professor Felice Jackham is the Director of Food and Mood Centre at Deakin University. Felice, this is not something that's just impacting the current generation. When we talk about food being used as an emotional vehicle for us, you've just got to look to popular culture, the idea of if you're broken up with or you break up with someone that you sit on the couch and you eat a tub of ice cream directly from the ice cream container, or you know, make your way through a box of chocolates. Can food make us feel better? Like, what is the emotional connection, do you think?
Well, there's a couple of aspects to that, of course. One is that, you know, the way it's been sold by industry, which is they've been incredibly effective at linking it to, you know, improved mood and happiness and family time and all of those sorts of things. But what we know from the research so far, and I should say that most of it is focused on the long-term associations between sort of daily diet and our mental health. But when we talk about the short term, is that these foods often do give us a bit of a dopamine hit. You know, they interact really strongly with the reward systems of our brain, and they give us those good feelings in many cases. But it's a bit like, I don't know, cigarettes or alcohol or something. The short-term impact is kind of the opposite of the long-term impact. And we know that these foods are linked to poor mental health in children, in adolescents, right across the age range.
What about the guilt that can become associated with food. So if you start to label food as good or bad, or if you're told you're not allowed to have one of those lolly snakes with all the other kids at the basketball game, then there's that idea of, well, the forbidden as well, and maybe you want the food that you're not allowed to have. If you do have it, then you feel really bad about it. What starts to happen to our brains if you add emotion and guilt to food?
Look, I think that's going to affect people differently at different stages of life. So for kids, of course, there's that idea of wanting to belong and being part of the group and everybody getting the same thing. And I do think it's really problematic when these foods are used in that context, because we shouldn't be normalising them, really. There's many other things that, you know, they could be consuming that are going to be a lot healthier. But for adolescents and young adults, a lot of the conversation about food focuses on body size, which I think has been really problematic. It's very stigmatising. People get really hung up on good foods and bad foods and guilt, and it can feed into orthorexia, which is an increasingly common eating disorder where people really focus on, oh my goodness, I've eaten that one bad thing and now, you know, my whole world is collapsing and I'm going to be huge tomorrow. And that's a massive issue, and it's not a healthy way of thinking about food. And I think our constant focus for the last couple of decades on obesity and body size, which of course is seen in social media everywhere, has been hugely problematic.
And look, it's been an issue for decades. We'll speak to the Butterfly Foundation in just a moment, but I can remember my nan. So we spent all of our lives at my nan and pa's, my auntie, my mum, and everyone would be there. They had a little, I think it was Reader's Digest, a little book that was a calorie counter that they would check while they were eating, right? They'd flick through. Wow. It would have the foods and then the amount of calories that you were consuming. Mm. Talk about anxiety and fear and guilt. And this little book sat on the dining table.
Really takes the enjoyment out of having a meal, doesn't it?
And that was the 80s. So, and I guess you had diet pill culture, all sorts of things at that time, Felice. So is any of this new?
Look, I don't think that it is, but maybe I think what we're facing is this massive issue of the global food environment and the food systems, which we know cost the globe absolute minimum of $20 trillion a year. Now, more than half of that is the impact on that awful industrialised food environment on our health, but the rest of it is mainly made up of the impact to the environment and that loss of biodiversity, which, of course, is linked to our own biodiversity and health. And so when people are trying to make these good choices, they're really up against it. I mean, you can't even fill up your car with petrol without being faced with opportunities to consume these foods as if they're very, very normal, but they're also cheap and heavily marketed and all the rest of it. So individuals are really up against it.
Stay with us, Felice. The emotion attached to food, both as a kid and as a parent. I know, Alex, I had this like light bulb moment one of the times you joined us on this program when you told us that we'd been sold the idea that breakfast has to be fun. And once I realised that, I actually had that conversation with my daughter and said, it doesn't have to be fun. Sometimes, yes, it is. You know, if you've got a friend sleeping over or birthdays or whatnot, of course breakfast can be fun. But actually, breakfast is just an important meal to make sure that you can concentrate during the day. But trying to break that narrative that we've been sold that it has to be fun, it has to be over the top, and things have got to pop and snap and everything.
Yeah,
that emotional connection to food. And if you don't get it, you either feel like as a kid you're being ripped off, or as a parent you're being really mean.
Yeah, the main reason we need to eat food is to nourish our bodies and fuel our bodies for whatever we're going to do each day. But the way food is marketed and promoted to us is that food is for fun, food is for celebration, breakfast cereals have to be colourful and crackly, and, you know, lunchbox snacks have to be colourful and unicorn shaped and whatever it be. And I think there's a real disconnect in the reasons why we need to eat and enjoy food for our physical and mental health, and then the way food is promoted to us. Most of the foods that are sold as fun through their packaging and through the ads that we see on TV or on digital media are really trying to sell us foods that we don't need to eat all the time. So there's a huge disconnect in what we ought to be eating all the time and the way food is actually marketed and promoted to us.
The idea of food as a reward, Sandro, does it ever work? Like, is it vaguely healthy and okay?
Well, I think it's hard to avoid any emotion being connected with food. Because if I think about my childhood, you know, I was actually talking about this with my partner last night over dinner preparing for this show, and we're talking about, you know, favourite childhood memories of food. And she said,
custard that my nan made.
Yeah, well, so mine, I remember my grandfather always, he always loved those little mini dim sims. So literally probably every school holidays, I have this like crazy memory, sharp memory of going to my grandma's house in Elgar Road in Surry Hills. You know, both passed away now, but and Gran would cook up, you know, piles of these, and there were the three boys. I was one of two brothers, and I remember eating them, you know, laughing, smiling with soy sauce, like thousands. I felt like thousands of them. Now every time I eat dim sims, it reminds me of my grandfather. Like, that's a wonderful memory. It doesn't come with judgment. It doesn't come with shame. I'm not worried about what I'm eating. So there is a really positive emotion that I've built with food, and through that I've built with cooking. I love cooking. And I can see now with my nieces, they love cooking because, again, they've done it from a very early age, connected with love and family. Now, that's not possible for everyone, and it's certainly not easy to do in today's busy lives. But, you know, emotion being connected with food is not always necessarily a bad thing. I think what I worry about is that there is so much guilt and shame and negative emotion connected with food, particularly for young people. It is largely being driven by, or increasingly, as Felice said, through social media. Mm. And it's often really weaponized. It's used as a way to make us feel bad to then sell us something, either a solution like a diet, or it's sold, you know, or it's a food that then we're being told is healthy when everything else we were told before wasn't. In 6 months it'll change and it's suddenly the opposite. Or a solution to all of our confusion. So that's the part that I really have a problem with. It's when it's kind of using negative emotions and then particularly manipulating the negative emotions to get us to often buy things that are actually not even good for us.
Felice, is that where you would like to see changes, tighter regulation, restrictions? I know last time we spoke about food and mood and how food is labelled. I mean, at the end of the day, is it just up to us as individuals, or can something be done to help guide us in some way?
Look, I think we need really effective food policy to really completely change our whole food system. And that's not just in Australia, that's around the world. You know, I'm working with fantastic researchers at Deakin, like Steve Allender and Globe, on how we might create these whole system maps and look at all of the points around the world where things can actually change. It is hard to unscramble an egg, though, and I think at the most basic individual level, I totally agree with Sandro that we need to be thinking about food in terms of its nurturing capacity and how it supports our bodies and our brains, and talking about what we add in less than focusing on what we should be avoiding.
Always good to speak with you, Felice. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks, Rochelle.
Professor Felice Jacka, the director of the Food and Mood Centre at Deakin University. I love this text and I couldn't agree with it more. And apologies if we haven't read out your text, because they are literally just flying in. This, it says, great conversation. Interestingly, in Thailand, whilst they do stop to eat breakfast, lunch and dinner, there is no differentiation between the types of food. They just have four dishes available. What is left over rolls into the next meal until that is finished, which means you might be having spicy chicken curry for breakfast with chili sardines and noodle soup. It's the best menu in the world. And I couldn't agree more. I used to spend quite a lot of time in Thailand and I would have spicy chicken curry for breakfast. And I remember having this moment, Alex, by thinking, why would you have eggs, right? Or Nutri-Grain or whatever it is that's being offered over there when you can have curry for breakfast? The idea of what we eat when.
Yeah, isn't it lovely to hear that food is just food, and if that's what you feel like eating, go for it. Have your curry noodles for breakfast and enjoy them. The other thing I love about that is we're not wasting anything, because any food can go at any meal. So you can repurpose it later that day or the next day and nothing's being wasted because it's not the right food for that meal. So, yeah, there's lots to love about that.
The difference between food when I was growing up in the 80s, says this text, is that there wasn't as much processed food. It's got harder, Sandro, right? Because the thing is, we're not idiots and we're all trying really hard. And
no, there are quite a few text messages saying, like,
you are an idiot.
You've become, basically, which is fair enough. The conversation's very extreme, and that's what a nanny state. We want to take away, you know, lollies and.
We don't.
I don't. I mean, definitely not. And I enjoy a bag of snakes as well. You know, so do my nieces. It's just how do we set kids up and also parents up to make kind of life a bit easier? And I was saying before, you know, kids can have as much fruit as they want. I mean, certainly in a halftime game with a box of quartered oranges, you're not going to have any problems kids, you know, having getting on the oranges. But, you know, it is a challenging one. And I think it brings out a lot of emotion because people feel as though we've probably in part because people feel as though they've got a lot more control and choice than we truly have. You know, as Pauline's saying, the food environment has changed so much since the 80s. There is a lot more kind of being forced upon kids. There's a lot more advertising and promotion, particularly in the digital space. Like the world has changed. We have to admit that.
Health is like this badge of honor now as well, and parenting styles and how you parent, and that's also become a badge of honor. And so for the couple of texts that are coming in saying, are you seriously talking about lolly snakes? It's more.
Yeah.
It's not about the lolly snake, but it is about the lolly snake.
Yeah. It's a big issue, I think, and especially when you bring in that lens of parenting, it's very easy to feel judged in how you are as a parent, whether it's around your food choices or your parenting styles. We all have had experiences of feeling under that spotlight. Mm. So I think we all probably need to be a bit kinder to ourselves when we're talking about these decisions and the way we operate.
Absolutely. And so that we can avoid that guilt and the bad emotion coming in. Because at the end of the day, we're all trying to educate ourselves more. We are all trying to do the right thing. But are we also creating a fear around so-called good food and bad food, and when we're allowed to and when we're not allowed to eat it?
ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Good morning, Rochelle Hunt and Dr. Sandra Mayo, the CEO of Vic Health, with you. Alex Chung in the studio as well, Senior Lecturer, Vic Health Postdoctoral Research Fellow from the Department of Nutrition, Dietetics and Food at Monash. That idea of trying to educate ourselves but not turn it into a fear. We're trying to educate ourselves, we're trying to educate our kids and the people that we love in our family. But as I said, you know, back in the 80s, there was that calorie counting book on my nana's dining room table. And I probably can't think of a woman in my family that doesn't have some kind of borderline issue or issue and relationship with their relationship with food, you know, that questions what they eat, that feels guilty about what they eat. And that's where we need to be careful. So we wanted to speak to Danny Rowlands. She's the Butterfly Foundation's Head of Prevention Services. Danny, you're also, you know, have children. I think you coach your daughter's netball team. You would have seen lolly snakes handed around as freely as water, as we are. How do we make sure we have educated conversations around this without creating fear around food?
Yeah, hi, Rochelle. It is a really complex and tricky issue, and one that we have been working with families and educators and young people around Australia for, nearly 20 years at the Butterfly Foundation. I think one of the biggest challenges that we have is that there's just so much confusing messaging out there when it comes to health, what is healthy. I've listened to some of the conversation and it's been really insightful and absolutely bang on when it comes to the messaging. And I think when it comes to, I guess, this fine line between how we're educating and helping young people, I think we do have to try, one, to reflect and understand where our own information has come from and what have we actually had access to, which obviously is our parents and our home environments, but also, of course, the television shows we've watched or coaches we might have had or other educators, and, of course, media and social media being such a big influence. So I think we do have to check in first with ourselves and understand what do we know and what is it.
That's confronting though, right?
It's really confronting.
Because, yeah, you don't start to realise your own potential issues that you have with food until you start to try and have conversations with children around food. And then all of a sudden you go, hang on a second, I don't want to pass any of these issues or hang-ups that I have about certain foods onto my kids, but you maybe didn't even realise you had them, Danny.
Well, this is, and I think this is it. We don't really give ourselves the space and time to really reflect, particularly as adults, when we're working and supporting young people in our lives. And I think that's a real challenge. We kind of come to adulthood and think, okay, I should have it all worked out, or that I should have a perfect relationship with food, or I shouldn't have body image issues or eating issues, or that all should have gone by now. But I think one of the biggest things and the biggest factors that I think we do need to, it's a bit like the elephant in the room, is that our society is incredibly fat phobic. And as a result of that, where we have weight stigma and we have weight discrimination that is absolutely rife in so many settings, that unfortunately for a lot of parents and a lot of people out there, that is actually what's governing and driving the way that they're trying to support their children, or just with relationships with eating and food, rather than looking at holistic health or well-being, it's very much looking at as weight. And I think when we're trying to stop our child from being a larger body, or ourselves from being a larger body, we're instantly starting to disorder our relationship with eating, exercise, and obviously also our body.
Has it got harder?
Yes.
Good. I thought it was just me.
No, it's not you. And as I said, I've been working in this space for a long time, and I think, you know, yes, we blame social media for a lot of things. It certainly is a contributor to this, but we have to recognise, as you mentioned, you've had access to diet books and things like that from in the 80s when social media wasn't a thing. So unfortunately now the intensity at which we can access health information, food information, nutrition information, where we can access information from people who are not experts or people who are just making this stuff up in the hope of gaining profit or power, is absolutely making it so much more complex.
At least the calorie counter was probably accurate, right? As confronting as it was, at least it's probably factual.
Yeah, it is. It is. But unfortunately, again, when we're looking to external sources to decide what our body needs, we're actually cutting ourselves off from actually being truly healthy. And people don't trust their body. They don't trust that it knows what it needs to survive. And that happens very early in our lives, where we start to, you know, even be I have to have lunch at this time because that's what happens at school. We're not listening to our body cues. We're not tuning into what our body needs, thinking about or feeling how food feels in our body. And that disconnect means that we're looking to external sources, such as being told you need 100 grams of protein, or that you need to have this many calories because of your body size. That doesn't actually
And who's telling you that?
Allow you to
Danny,
get what you need.
Stay with us. I'm going to have a chat to Kim. Hi, Kim. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you today?
Really well. What did you want to say?
Oh, I was just listening with interest to the program, and my background in another lifetime is as a counsellor. And I wanted to make a comment about the use of the terms positive and negative emotions, which I actually think is really perhaps unhelpful. I think it's better to think of emotions as just something that is, neither good nor bad, they just are. And that what we do about those emotions and how we manage them is what really matters. Mm. Yeah.
And is that sort of in the similar ways how we label food good and bad and how we use food to manage our emotions? Do you think it's connected?
I'm not sure, but I guess if I can just go back on a little bit, often in my previous role, which was involved in trauma counselling, I would hear people say that they're feeling really angry, and then they'd be disappointed and guilty with themselves for feeling angry. And really what they're doing is following a really unhealthy thought pattern down the rabbit hole.
Yeah, it's very similar, isn't it? Because the guilt is what we were talking about, Sandro, as well. Like the last thing you want, and even if you are eating that lolly snake, you don't want to be eating it with a side serve of guilt, because then there's no fun in that.
No, and I think it goes back also, you know, to the conversation from Danny that we sort of put so much onus back on the individual. We make it very kind of biomedical. Often it's linked with weight rather than actual health or even how we feel. And we sort of miss the point in a way, which is, trying to find ways I would put it to kind of feel good, and feel healthy, I suppose, as much as we possibly can.
Professor Felice Jacka earlier, Danny, from the Food and Mood Centre at Deakin, was talking about wanting, I guess, stricter regulations around how we label food and what we do. Yep. When we look at health washing and Fitspro or whatever it's called, you know, those all those health influencers and fitness influencers, how problematic is that? Do you want to see tighter regulation or more transparent information around sponsorships or whatever it may be on socials?
Yeah, look, it is that there does need to be some pretty urgent action in relation to how platforms are governed and how information, misinformation, disinformation, fake news, all can be represented online without really, you know, any accountability at the end of the day. I think we are putting a lot of onus on the individual to kind of be savvy and to make sure that they're applying a critical eye and not taking it all too seriously. But people obviously source that information when they're feeling quite vulnerable. So we absolutely need to see that that change happening at that system level. And it's not just social media. It's also we need to see it within the diet, wellness, you know, industries, fitness industries, to make sure that the information people are getting is sound, is obviously balanced, and not sensationalised. And again, just trying to really gain someone profit or power, you know, which is ultimately what's happening. And the person at the other end is the one who suffers.
Tani, can I ask? I mean, it sounds kind of overwhelming. It's this big behemoth of a challenge. I mean, is there any country that's doing it well? Anyone we can learn from elsewhere? Australia is always, we're a competitive nation. We like to be the best. You know, is there anyone that's doing it better that we could kind of learn from?
Look, that's a great question. And I, in relation to, I guess, the nutrition side of things or the information online, I know each country, particularly like the US and the UK, are doing a lot of work in that regulation space. In Australia, though, like Butterfly Foundation is working with social media platforms to try to help govern and regulate as best we can. I think the hard thing is it's like one thing kind of happens and you know, think, yes, you've taken a win, but then something new evolves. And I guess that's our real danger, is that we have these platforms that exist that can keep morphing and evolving, just like diet industries and weight loss industries. They just keep morphing and evolving meet what the community needs or wants, and it looks different all the time. So I think we need to, you know, really, it really needs to look at that when things are initially developed, or, you know, what are the safeguards in place and what can we do around all of that. I'm not an expert in obviously all that kind of higher level governance stuff. I'm probably more about advocating
and
educating level.
Just finally, Dani, that idea, we are all trying to educate ourselves more, right? We're all reading the backs and labels and figuring out what is sugar, what is fat and what not. Does that potentially tip into a fear and an anxiety? And at the Butterfly Foundation, do you worry then about eating disorders that can arise from what primarily starts from trying to educate ourselves?
Yeah, and I think this is a really, there's a really fine line with that education piece, in that we're, you know, trying to help young people in particular, if we go there, you know, to understand nutrition and what food, you know, how food can support our body to do the things that we want to do in our life and perform. Unfortunately, though, we have a very tight connection between weight and worth, and as a result of that, the looking at labels and the looking at the macro and micronutrients and things that are being promoted means that we are starting to really get young people obsessed. And we do have young people are very vulnerable, and older people are too. Everyone is, I would say, at this point in time.
Yeah.
I think we just need to be really mindful that obsession, and there is a disordered eating, or it sits very, very close to an eating disorder, which is called orthorexia, where there's just an absolute hyper focus on healthy eating, pure eating, and obviously
That's the one Felice was saying, they're seeing growing numbers of that.
Yes.
Dani, thank you so much for your time and for the work that you and your entire foundation does. We really appreciate it.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
It's Dani Rollins from the Butterfly Foundation. And of course, they have a national helpline. The number's 1-800-334-673. So the Butterfly Foundation, if it's for yourself, maybe you've just got some questions, this is raising some alarms for you, or there's someone in your life, they've got a national helpline, 1-800-334-673. we knew when we started out today that this really wasn't a conversation about lolly snakes. I mean, there's a text here that says, Rochelle, this is totally about the lolly snakes for you. You need to go get yourself some counselling. Look, maybe I do, right? Who's to say? I mean, counselling is good for anyone and everyone. This is bigger.
Mm.
But what it does is it represents almost a moment in time, Alex, of where we're at with food labelling, what we understand about food, and the shame and the guilt and all of this stuff that's wrapped into just a bag of brightly coloured stretchy snakes.
Yeah, for me it really shows that food is very emotive, and as we've heard, there is a fine line between wanting to read labels, understand what's healthy and making really healthy choices for our young people, and being careful of not really polarising food and making sure that we're not creating rules and restrictions around food where people can then start to really
Obsess, as Danny says.
Or fall into quite unhealthy or unhelpful habits around food being bad or restricted or that kind of thing. So it's definitely a fine line. I've really enjoyed the conversation.
Mm. Sandra, you're a man of power. Can't you get free boxes of fruit to sporting games? Come on.
Well, it is happening. But I think there's a bigger conversation here. People, get angry at the idea of taking away snakes. I think people are challenged by the idea that, you know, we're being told what to eat or influenced by industry. I think there's a lot to unpack here. And for me, it's just showing again how much fear and stigma and shame there is around food and how much work we have to do as a nation.
I think we need to bring both, you know, have the lolly snakes and the oranges side by side. They can get along, right?
Not a bad idea.
They can get along. There's a text here that says, my six-year-old daughter came home from school with this yesterday, and she sent me a picture of all these different images and foods that have been ripped out of a catalogue. My kids have become obsessed with the health star rating, and that worries me. Just finally, Sandra, I mean, that's the thing, right? This is a six-year-old that's starting to obsess about the health star rating.
Well, I think, it shows we shouldn't be individualising this. It's not about telling kids not to eat something or getting a five-year-old start looking at the back of the packets and reading the nutrition label. That's our job as parents. That's our job as adults. And I think it's making as much as possible the default environment where kids spend time as healthy and fun as possible.
Dr. Sandra DiMaio, CEO of Vic Health, as always, thank you. We've done heaps of conversations like this on food, on health, on processed food, on how we label food. So go to the Conversation Hour podcast, go to the ABC Listen app and download. Talk soon.